on CFRC 101.9 FM every Friday afternoon from 4 to 6 p.m. You'll hear Finding a Voice. My name is Bruce, host of that poetry-focused spoken word program. On it, you'll hear local readings and events, occasionally telephone interviews across Canada, and always a touch of music. Again, Finding a Voice, here every Friday from 4 to 6 p.m. Check it out. Hope to catch you there.
Greetings, loved ones. This is DJ Nasty Nexus coming to you live and direct from CFRC 101.9. I'm here to bring you the goods from my new show, Classless Radio, airing every Friday night at 11 p.m. I'll be giving you hits and hidden gems all the way from jazz to blues and hip-hop and R&B. Music from the soul that everybody needs. Hop on my wavelengths and get right with the kid to kick off your big weekend. Stay tuned.
Welcome to Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. On this episode, Total War. Ali Abu Nima reports on the political and economic fallout and the historical background of Western hostility towards Iran.
Iran, that has been the target of American, European, Israeli, and Arab regime aggression for decades, since the 1979 revolution that overthrew the brutal regime of the Shah, which had ruled Iran since it was installed in a CIA coup in 1953. That coup overthrew the democratic, popular, and nationalist government of Mohammad Mossadegh, which wanted to nationalize Iran's oil industry and other resources.
And John Elmer covers the first 5 days of the U.S. and Israeli war against Iran as the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps strikes back.
Iranians, 500 ballistic missiles, 2,000 drones, and the IRGC said 40% have been aimed at Israel and 60% at U.S. bases and consulates throughout the region.
This is Electronic Intifada Radio. I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. This episode highlights the news, interviews, and reports from our live stream broadcast on March 5th, 2026. Later in the show, Iran strikes back after the U.S. and Israel launch war. The Electronic Intifada's John Elmer looks at the military dimension of the conflict on the resistance report. But first, Iran announced that the United States and Israel had killed Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, as well as several members of his family. They join hundreds of Iranians already slain in the American-Israeli war, including scores of schoolgirls massacred in an unspeakable atrocity at an elementary school in Minab in southern Iran. The Electronic Intifada's Ali Abu Nima talks about this enormous crime against Iran, but explains that time is on Iran's side.
The United States and Israel launched a war of aggression against Iran, murdering its leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and declaring that their goal is to topple the country's system of government. Killing Ayatollah Khamenei, the leader of a sovereign state who is also a revered spiritual leader to tens of millions of Muslims in an unprovoked war of aggression, is a flagrant act of international terrorism. It is an enormous crime. In the first few days, the joint attack, including indiscriminate bombing of civilians, has, according to the latest count, killed 1,045 people in Iran and injured thousands more. Iran is retaliating against U.S. bases and assets across the Gulf region and against Israel, killing 24 people, 11 in Israel and about a dozen in other countries so far. From Lebanon, Hezbollah has joined the battle, targeting Israeli positions. Israeli bombing has killed more than 100 people across Lebanon and displaced tens of thousands more. Today, Israel threatened the entire population of Beirut's southern suburb, telling them they had to evacuate. It is total war. The scenes across Iran show that Israel and the United States are engaging in an indiscriminate bombing of civilians. In addition to the more than 1,000 people killed, Iran's health ministry says that 2,500 people are being treated in hospital and thousands more were treated and released. 180 of those killed are children, most in the horrific massacre on the first day in the elementary school in Minab in southern Iran. Middle East Eye has managed to collect the names of many of these children and their ages, and most of them are under the age of 10 years old. In a repeat of Israel's Gaza Doctrine, also known as the Dahiya Doctrine, which is the deliberate, indiscriminate destruction of civilian infrastructure, the U.S. and Israel are targeting civilian institutions across Iran. They've hit 21 hospitals, according to Iranian authorities. They're also attacking emergency services, police stations, courts, sports stadiums, and other civil and governmental facilities with the goal of destroying the Iranian state and society. Let's listen to Ahmed Nejatian, the president of the Iranian Nursing Organization, speaking from Tehran earlier.
Here is a central hospital in Tehran where in the last few days where it was opened to provide healthcare services to all citizens. Unfortunately, after a very heavy air attacks to the near of this hospital, many of wards of this hospital was destroyed and all the patient was evacuated and transferred to other hospitals.
So what are the U.S. and Israeli goals and where are we going? The U.S. and Israel seem to have made a major miscalculation. It looks like their strategy was that a quick shock and awe attack and the murder of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei would lead to the quick collapse of the government, the military, and bring on a popular uprising. In other words, they didn't expect there to be very much fighting. Let's look now at how U.S. President Donald Trump set up this attack in his video address announcing the assault on 28th of February.
From Lebanon to Yemen and Syria to Iraq, the regime has armed, trained, and funded terrorist militias that have soaked the earth with blood and guts. And it was Iran's proxy, Hamas, that launched the monstrous October 7th attacks on Israel, slaughtering more than 1,000 innocent people, including 46 Americans, while taking 12 of our citizens hostage. It was brutal, something like the world has never seen before. Iran is the world's number one state sponsor of terror and just recently killed tens of thousands of its own citizens on the street as they protest.
So that's the narrative. We've heard it many times before. And of course, the claims about tens of thousands of Iranian protesters being killed have no basis in reality. More than 3,000 people were killed, Iran acknowledged, but they say that it was as a result of a U.S. and Mossad-backed insurgency, and hundreds of them were police and soldiers. Trump also claimed that Iran was trying to develop nuclear weapons and long-range missiles that could threaten the U.S., and he calls Iranian leaders evil. Then he says the following.
Finally, to the great, proud people of Iran, I say tonight that the hour of your freedom is at hand. Stay sheltered. Don't leave your home. It's very dangerous outside. Bombs will be dropping everywhere. When we are finished, take over your government. It will be yours to take. This will be probably your only chance for generations. For many years, you have asked for America's help, but you never got it. No president was willing to do what I am willing to do tonight.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made similar statements about overthrowing the government, but I'm going to spare us all the additional suffering of listening to him. Now, this was the same calculation underlying the Israeli-American attack on Iran in June last year, the so-called 12-day war, and it was the calculation underlying the terrorist insurgency sponsored by Mossad in the United States in January that I just mentioned. It's unclear why they think that what failed repeatedly would work this time. I suspect they truly believed their own propaganda that Iran is a one-man dictatorship and that Khamenei was hated, and killing him would be the factor that made the difference this time, but it didn't work. In a country of 90 million people, there are undoubtedly some who hate their government to the extent that they would support an all-out war against their own country. But there has been no sign of a popular uprising against the government. On the contrary, there has been a massive national outpouring of support for the martyred leader and demands for revenge every night in cities across the country. Here, for example, in Zahedan, you can hear people chanting in support of the army in the IRGC, the Islamic Republican Guard Corps. And you can see them holding pictures of Imam Khamenei. There is simply no evidence that the Iranian people are about to overthrow their government. So, having failed to foment an uprising, it looks like the United States and Israel are going to the familiar tactic of trying to stoke civil war and terrorism, just as they did in Syria. Look at this headline in the New York Times: pro-American Kurdish forces are preparing possible Iran incursion. And it says, pro-American Iranian Kurdish forces based in Iraq are preparing armed units that could enter Iran, creating a potential new front in an already expanding conflict, according to Iraqi officials and senior members of Iranian Kurdish groups. The CIA has previously given small arms to the Iranian Kurdish forces as part of a covert program to destabilize Iran, an effort that began before the current war, according to people familiar with this effort. So the United States and Israel have been fomenting terrorism and insurgency against Iran for a long time. The Washington Post has a similar story, goes even further. The headline there, Trump calls on Kurds to aid U.S. effort in Iran, offers support. And it says, the Trump administration bracing for more U.S. casualties and considering whether to put ground troops in Iran has begun reaching out to Tehran's domestic opposition as potential allies to foment an uprising against the regime. In calls this week to Kurdish minority leaders in Iran and neighboring Iraq, President Donald Trump offered extensive U.S. air cover and other backing for anti-regime Iranian Kurds to take over portions of western Iraq. But as we can see, this even raises, as some other officials have, the prospect of directly putting U.S. ground troops in there as well. So we're heading for escalation. Now, let's look at the situation in Israel. Here's a headline from the Times of Israel. Poll: most Jewish Israelis support Iran war toppling regime. And the story tells us an overwhelming majority of Jewish Israelis support Israel's ongoing military campaign against Iran, and many believe it should continue until the fall of the Islamic Republic. That's according to a poll by the Israel Democracy Institute. The poll found profound backing for Operation Roaring Lion, as Israel calls it, among Jewish respondents, with 93% expressing support. And this is important because we're often told by politicians in the West that the problem is Benjamin Netanyahu. You'll often hear, for example, Senator Bernie Sanders and other so-called progressives in the U.S. directing their criticism at Netanyahu by name and not at Israel. But what these numbers tell us, as polls have throughout the genocide in Gaza, is it's not just a Netanyahu problem, it's an Israel problem. This is a fully genocidal society. Now, there's a lot of debate in the United States about whether this war was for Israel and whether Trump and the United States were dragged into war for Israel. And we've heard many senior officials, including Marco Rubio and Donald Trump himself, making comments that the war was to defend Israel, or that Israel would have started the war and then Iran would have attacked, so we had to go in preemptively. They keep changing their story. To me, I think we have to say that it is a war for Israel, but it is just as equally, if not more so, a war of U.S. global dominance and imperialism. Nonetheless, in the last 30 years that I've been observing events, I've never before seen such a backlash against Israel in the United States, with people on the left and right saying openly that it's a war for Israel and they don't want to fight it. And yet, some are demanding not only ground troops in Iran, but direct U.S. involvement in Lebanon as well. And I want to show you this clip of Senator Lindsey Graham directly addressing President Donald Trump.
One thing to President Trump, in case you're watching. In 1983, Ronald Reagan sent Marines and sailors to try to police and deal with the Lebanese civil war. They were at the end of the runway. Hezbollah attacked the Marine barracks, killed 220 Marines, 18 sailors, and wounded 100 others. Ronald Reagan, who I admire and love, withdrew and never did anything about it. So I'm calling on President Trump today. Join Israel to attack Hezbollah. Avenge the Marines. America never forgets. Those 220 Marines and 18 sailors' families, we want to go after the infrastructure that killed your loved ones. They're IRGC assets in Beirut as I speak. President Trump, come up with a new operation called Semper Fi. Fly with Israel and go after Hezbollah, who has American blood on its hands. Not only take the mothership of Iran down, also take the proxy of Hezbollah, settle the score, even the account.
So you could see where Lindsey Graham wants this to go. Now, I want to look at a little bit at the bigger picture of this war. John will be taking us through the military aspects, which are crucial, but this is not just a military war. It is also a global economic war. And as of right now, the Strait of Hormuz is effectively closed. This is the narrow passage that all ships have to pass through to get in and out of the Persian Gulf. About 1/5 of world oil and liquefied natural gas passes through this narrow passageway. There are virtually no ships going through. The very few that appear to be going through are mostly Iranian vessels. And it's likely to stay like this as long as the war goes on. What happens if ships try to go through? Very simple. There is a very high risk they will get attacked. The UK Maritime Trade Operations Centre, UKMTO, a British government organization, reported on an incident that is likely to deter any ships from trying to run the strait. And according to the UKMTO, this incident occurred while a ship was passing eastbound through the Straits of Hormuz. A container ship was hit by an unknown projectile just above the waterline, causing a fire in the engine room. The crew had to abandon the ship. They were all accounted for with no injuries. UKMTO also reported that an oil tanker was attacked and set on fire early on Thursday morning in the Northern Gulf. Iran's Islamic Republican Guard Corps later said that its naval forces struck an American oil tanker in the northern Persian Gulf early Thursday, setting it ablaze. And the IRGC reiterated its position that under international law and regulations, control over passage through the Strait of Hormuz rests with the Islamic Republic of Iran during wartime. Donald Trump has talked about the U.S. Navy providing escorts through the strait, but this is basically impossible because it would bring U.S. ships within easy reach of Iranian drones and anti-ship missiles. Right now, U.S. ships are staying very far outside the Persian Gulf. Trump has also talked about the U.S. government providing financial backing for shipping insurance, but that does not seem to have done much to calm fears. The Financial Times reports, the cost of insuring ships sailing through the Strait of Hormuz has soared 12-fold, even after Donald Trump vowed to backstop trade through the key oil choke point. Ship owners have been quoted millions of dollars for cover to cross the strait or sail in nearby high-risk waters, brokers said, as premiums jumped as high as 3% of the cost of a ship on Wednesday, up from 0.25% before the war. It's a lot of money. So the impacts of the closure of the Strait of Hormuz have been immediate and will ripple globally. Qatar, which is the third largest producer of liquefied natural gas, and that accounts for about 1/5 of global output, Qatar Energy declared force majeure. This means that it cannot meet its contract obligations to customers. So basically, 1/5 of global LNG production just shut down and it is unlikely it will resume while the war continues. In fact, impossible. Immediately, European natural gas prices surged 46% to a three-year high. Already less than a week into this war, India, one of the world's most populous countries, is rationing gas. The position is pretty much the same with crude oil. Kuwait and other oil producers, including Iraq, largely rely on ships to bring their oil to customers. Those ships are not going to be moving. Maersk, the world's biggest global logistics company, announced on Wednesday that it is halting all cargo operations in and out of the UAE, Oman, Iraq, Kuwait, Qatar, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, until further notice. This is with immediate notice. Exceptions will be made for critical foodstuff, medicine, and other essential goods. So you can see how dire the situation is there. All of this can have cascading consequences that ripple through global supply chains very quickly and in unforeseen ways. So, for example, here is one report claiming that the enormous spike in shipping insurance costs could severely affect the global shipment of electronics components. So that would have effects on pretty much all manufacturing. Cars now are mostly computers, for example. In addition to the closure of sea routes, much of the airspace of the region is shut down from Israel, Lebanon, Jordan, Iraq, and across the Gulf. That is not only affecting hundreds of thousands of passengers, but also air cargo, since Gulf-based air carriers are major players in international shipping by air. In the Gulf region, you have Emirates, Etihad, Qatar, and so on. And in the Gulf region, countries like Qatar and the United Arab Emirates, where Dubai is located, have increasingly tried to shift their economies from fossil fuels to tourism, financial services, and real estate. In other words, to turn their countries into appealing global brands. All of those industries rely on confidence and trust that these are safe and peaceful countries. And in just a few days, decades of marketing work has gone up in smoke. So these are just some of the economic effects visible in less than a week of this war. What will be the global impact if it continues for weeks or months or longer? What will be the effect, for example, on global inflation and on politics in all of these countries, particularly the United States, where ordinary people are going to be paying the price? Iran knows all of this is very costly. And as Dr. Mohammad Marandi from the University of Tehran has told us when he's been on our program and many other programs, this is part of Iran's strategy. Iran has made clear that it will do its best to make a war of aggression against it as costly as possible. And things appear to be unfolding now pretty much exactly as he predicted. Now, I want to come back to my article that I mentioned earlier, An Enormous Crime Against Iran. One of my goals with this article was to counter the narrative we're all fed night and day, and you heard Donald Trump say at the beginning of this segment and many, many times after that, that Iran is an aggressive country run by evil, violent, irrational leaders. And I want to counter that narrative, and I want to counter it with the truth, which is the exact opposite. It is, in fact, Iran that has been the target of American, European, Israeli, and Arab regime aggression for decades, since the 1979 revolution that overthrew the brutal regime of the Shah, which had ruled Iran since it was installed in a CIA coup in 1953. That coup overthrew the democratic, popular, and nationalist government of Mohammad Mossadegh, which wanted to nationalize Iran's oil industry and other resources for the country's own use and the development and well-being of its people. That could not be allowed. In 1980, as Iran was consolidating its post-revolutionary order after overthrowing the brutal U.S.-backed Shah dictatorship, Iraq invaded Iran. But that war was not merely Saddam Hussein's project. It was supported and armed by the United States and European powers and funded by the same Arab regimes that are now complicit in the U.S.-Israeli war of aggression. Even if they say that they are not involved, the United States couldn't do it without their airspace, their territory, their bases, their radars, a whole military infrastructure across the region that John will be telling us about. West Germany, of all countries, was instrumental in Iraq's production of chemical weapons that were used to attack Iranians during the Iran-Iraq war. Even Iran's formidable ballistic missile force has its roots in this period. Iraq's indiscriminate Scud missile attacks on Iran's population centers during the so-called War of the Cities, which killed thousands of Iranian civilians, that's what convinced the country's leaders of the need for an effective defensive deterrent. Iran has not invaded its neighbors. It has not waged wars of conquest. It has not overthrown the leaders of other countries. Its missile strikes have come only after direct attacks, whether the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani in 2019 by the United States or Israeli strikes on Iranian territory. Iran survived 8 years of devastation as a result of the Western and Arab regime-backed Iraqi invasion. Since then, it has faced wave after wave of assassinations and sanctions, calculated to immiserate its population, from denying them cancer treatments to causing crashes of civilian airliners because Iran is banned from importing new aircraft or even spare parts to repair the old planes. Despite Arab regime hostility, Iran has supported Palestinian and Lebanese resistance against Israeli occupation, apartheid, and genocide. This is undoubtedly its main transgression in the eyes of pro-Israel Arabs and their Western sponsors. And of course, instead of describing this as what it is, solidarity with peoples waging just struggles of liberation, it's presented as interference or support for proxies. That's the narrative that's used to demonize Iran's solidarity with the Palestinian people and other people waging anti-colonial struggles in the region. U.S. officials boast that sanctions have collapsed Iran's currency, created economic hardship, and along with covert Israeli and American destabilization efforts, fomented violence. We're seeing the culmination of these decades of aggression in this barbaric war targeting the Iranian people and their state. Iran is the last stop on Washington and Tel Aviv's regime change train after Iraq, Libya, and Syria, and the installation of docile vassal regimes elsewhere across the region. So, to sum up, this is an existential war for Iran. From its perspective, it has to go all the way to win to ensure that the cost of attacking it ever again is too high for the U.S., for Israel, and for regional states that hosted bases being used in these attacks. Iran may have concluded that the only way to ensure its security is to drive the United States out of the region once and for all. From Iran's perspective, it is fight or die. So Iran is not going to stop until it believes its objectives are met. This also makes it an existential war for Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah had to enter the war because if it sits on the sidelines and Iran is defeated, Hezbollah will be finished anyway. Therefore, its leaders must have calculated that they had to join in to maximize Iran's chances of winning. The same logic may hold for Ansarullah in Yemen and resistance groups in Iraq, although we have not seen Ansarullah rejoin hostilities just yet. The U.S. has started a war it had no plan for, except for a plan that didn't work, that the Iranians would rise up and do the job for them. Donald Trump and Israel made a catastrophically bad bet. They can either admit that and retreat, which would rightly be seen as an enormous defeat for them and a victory for Iran, or they can escalate and hope to turn things around. Iran knows it will pay a high cost, but it can afford to stretch this out longer. Relatively speaking, time favors Iran. Escalation looks like the most certain scenario, and it will definitely be costly for all. But at the end of this, the region and the world will be different. For Iran, the stakes are not just survival, but the possibility of a region free of U.S. and Israeli imperialism and dominance. And that is undoubtedly the hope of many people beyond Iran as well.
That was the Electronic Intifada's Executive Director, Ali Abu Nima. You're listening to Electronic Intifada Radio with me, Nora Barrows-Friedman. The Those are the cheers of children in Gaza after an Iranian retaliation against Israel. Iran strikes back after the U.S. and Israel launch war. The Electronic Intifada's John Elmer has more.
This is the resistance report for day 881 of Israel's genocide in Gaza and day 6 of U.S.-Israeli war on Iran. We're going to cover the first 5 days of this war, and let's start with the Strait of Hormuz, the choke point of global energy. 20% of the natural gas from Qatar and 20% of the oil that the world uses comes through that strait. The commander of the naval force of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said that the United States cannot escort ships out of the Strait of Hormuz. Trump cannot send his fleet to extract those stuck in the Gulf or open the Strait of Hormuz. Trump says, "We will escort the ships if necessary. Now is the time for necessity, Mr. Trump, so come and escort your ships." Of course, that puts them well within range of short-range ballistic missiles, anti-ship missiles. So the Iranians are taunting the Americans to actually escort those ships. That would be a massive undertaking for the Americans, and they do not have the warships in the area right now to do that. So it would involve another buildup. So for now, I think the energy markets are going to spike for sure. Bases are the main targets of this battle. Each of these countries moving from the shores of Iran out, the UAE, Qatar, Bahrain, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Jordan, and of course, Israel are the main thrusts of it. The U.S. has said that it has dropped 2,000 bombs in the first 30 hours of this war. 1,000 were in the first 13 hours of the war. They've struck more than 2,000 targets. The Israeli Air Force said this morning that they've dropped over 5,000 bombs in strikes. The Iranians say 500 ballistic missiles and more than 2,000 drones have been launched. Hegseth, the defense secretary, outlined the mission. He said the mission of Epic Fury is laser focused. Destroy Iranian offensive missiles, destroy Iranian missile production, destroy the Navy and other security infrastructure. So this is a regime change operation. And as Ali pointed out, Trump has 47 years of grievances against Iran that they're using to justify this regime change. The bases that have been targeted, these are the key bases in the UAE. The key bases there, Al Udeid in Kuwait is the CENTCOM main air base. And then beside it, Bahrain is the 5th Fleet, which is the naval command for the entire region. Targeting in Kuwait, there's a significant force in Kuwait. The numbers in between Kuwait, Bahrain, and Qatar are more than 40,000 American troops in those bases. But the number of military bases and installations that have been targeted by the Iranians are in the dozens. They've also hit diplomatic and strategic facilities like embassies. CIA stations are all in those embassies. And the CIA said this week that they are evacuating all of their CIA offices that are in, usually they're in the embassies, particularly because the one in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia, was hit. And Saudi Arabia also hosts that key air base, Prince Sultan Air Base. And in Jordan, Muwaffaq al-Salti Air Base, that hosts the American Expeditionary Wing. The buildup that the U.S. is concentrating their forces on that air base rather than having them all spread out. So the air defense tactic is to concentrate their troops on a few of the bases and then use the carrier that is in the Mediterranean and its guided missile destroyers as basically air defense for Israel. We're going to start with the school massacre because, of course, this is the way Israel fights its wars and the Americans do too. The massacre at this school, 168 schoolgirls aged 7 to 12 were killed along with 15 of their teachers. There was two strikes on the school in southeast Iran in the town of Minab. Six buildings, including the school and the clinic, were destroyed. Despite Trump saying, "Don't go outside your house, it's scary, there's bombs falling, you don't want to be out there," there was a massive funeral demonstration for these schoolgirls showing just the kind of resolve that I don't think the Americans expected in this war. But the street scenes of those funeral marches were incredible. Under the scale of bombing that's happening, 7,000 bombs, according to the U.S. and Israelis at minimum. And there was tens of thousands of people out on the streets mourning that funeral. the war began with these two strikes, the strike on the school and then the strike on the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, and he was killed at a meeting. So the key to the way the war started is it started on the first day of the work week in Iran, and it started at 9:30 in the morning. So when people were all out in the streets and people were meeting in their offices in the National Security Council in Iran, and the Americans and Israelis managed to kill in that assassination, not just Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, but also the commander-in-chief of the Islamic Revolutionary Guards, the minister of defense, the head of the military council, the commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps Aerospace Force, as well as the deputy intelligence minister in that. Again, perfidy by the Israelis, because the Iranians believed that they were still in negotiations. After the last round of negotiations just last week, negotiations were supposed to continue and they had plans to meet again. And so again, Iran trusting its enemy to be honorable, which we know from 2.5 years of war with Israel is not the case. A poster put out by the PFLP's Abu Ali Mustafa Brigades calls Khamenei a martyr on the road to Al-Quds and Palestine. And also the Qassam Brigade spoke about the martyred leader, and this is what they said. The martyred leader, Ali Khamenei, represented the primary supporter of the Axis of Resistance, Palestine, and its fighters. Indeed, all the Islamic Republic has provided for decades in terms of support and backing for our people and our resistance, at the heart of which are the Al-Qassam Brigades, was by his direct decision and under his full patronage. This great support and backing for the path of resistance constituted an essential and important factor that contributed to the development of the resistance and its tactics, leading to the great creativity it displayed in Al-Aqsa flood and the legendary steadfastness for 2 full years in the face of the most powerful forces of injustice in the region. So saluted by all of the Palestinian resistance factions, of course, from all of the factions, from the leftists, all the way across the political spectrum of the resistance groups. Next here, a promo that was put out by Khamenei's Office of Preservation and Publication for the works of Ali Khamenei. They put out this, and he says here, "We are not the initiators of war. However, anyone who shows their greed and seeks to attack or cause harm will face a decisive blow from the Iranian nation." Ali Larijani, the secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, the top security figure right now in Iran, said, "As in the past 300 years, Iran did not start this war and our brave armed forces are not engaged in any attack except for defense. We will fiercely defend ourselves and our 6,000-year-old civilization regardless of the costs, and we will make the enemy regret their miscalculations. Iran, unlike the United States, is prepared for a long war." Also, just to note, Ali Khamenei had a fatwa against nuclear weapons for many, many years, decades even, and him saying that was in the preamble of the JCPOA. So again, putting lie to the American propaganda, as always, from their short-range missiles all the way to their more sophisticated, high-end, long-range, solid fuel and advanced missiles, which, according to the IRGC, have not been used yet. They said they have been saving them and using old stock. They have missiles for every purpose in this war, for each distance, for each outcome. So a significant missile force that has been built up over more than a generation and is being put into use today. They're also within range of drones, which they have been using significantly. And we saw that in the previous 3 Iranian exchanges of fire, True Promise 1, 2, and 3. And this is True Promise 4 that we are in right now. The Israelis and the Americans have been showing us lots of footage of launchers being knocked out because lots of them are truck launches. They're easier to track once they have been launched. But when you see these kind of underground facilities, these are very difficult for Israel to get. They don't know where they are, unlike the nuclear facilities where they knew where they were and had previous interactions with the United Nations inspectors and whatnot. These missile bases are not known to the Israelis. You know, these are missiles that cost maybe high hundreds of thousands, early 1 millions to make. And the interceptors that are knocking them down that are not built as fast are in the $3 million to $27 million range. So there is a massive discrepancy in the outlay of costs in this war, which will also, over time, be a damning factor for the U.S. and its stocks. The first week of the war, we don't need to worry too much about missile stockpiles and interceptor stockpiles. But I've talked about it on this show a number of times when we were covering Yemen, that the missile math, it's very finite. The interceptors are expensive. The military buildup for this war was very fast. It wasn't planned, so they didn't have a chance to increase domestic production, which is something that almost can't really happen in the U.S., the way the economy is shaped, and is particularly the military-industrial complex is shaped. So these things will all be significant as the days go on. Iranians, 500 ballistic missiles, 2,000 drones, and IRGC said 40% have been aimed at Israel and 60% at U.S. bases and consulates throughout the region. Okay, so here's some strikes on Israel. Again, there's massive censorship in Israel. We're watching the streaks in the sky and the massive blast hitting Tel Aviv. And of course, they tell you in Tel Aviv that these aren't landing and that they have 100% interception rates. In fact, the next video, they're on the air talking about how the Iron Dome gets all the rockets and gets all the missiles. And then this one comes right in, right while they're talking. The censorship in Israel has been remarkable. The threat of jail time will do it, I guess, for people. Also, there's a nationalistic element in it that they don't want to be. I assume that there's a nationalistic element of not wanting to be shown to be humiliated in front of the world. But for whatever it is, the number of videos coming out from Israel compared to the 12-day war, which itself was shrouded in censorship, is even less this time around. This is the sound of what the war sounds like in Beersheba in southern Israel. So this was from the 11th wave of Operation True Promise. The IRGC is releasing their field reports in waves that they talk about. And this wave included Beersheba, where there's an IDF industrial communications complex in the city. And that barrage, wave 11, targeted 20 sites across Israel. So spreading out the attacks, keeping the entire country moving to shelters, these are strategies rather than using advanced missiles. They've been saying they're using their old stock up and keeping people on the run throughout Israel from the north to the south. And that is clearly part of the strategy of this. We are going to now go to Bahrain. So this is the targeting of the 5th Fleet, the U.S. Naval Command in Manama, Bahrain. The Bahrainis don't seem to have much problem with the U.S. bases being targeted. Of course, in each of these countries, there's movements to get rid of these bases that are stamped out by the royal families that run these countries as their own personal fiefdoms. So that is Bahrain, 5th Fleet. This is a critical site for the Americans overseeing the entire region between the 5th Fleet and Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar. Forms the real core of the U.S. presence in the region. This is again the 5th Fleet. And this next one is the targeting of hotels. And let me just say before we show this, that this is the targeting of hotels of U.S. troops. The IRGC said, the flight of cowardly U.S. soldiers from regional bases, they're taking refuge in hotels in host countries and their criminal army's use of civilian facilities in the Persian Gulf countries as cover do not escape the intelligence monitoring of the IRGC. There's times where people wouldn't have thought this was possible to see this. These bases have been built, particularly they were built for, they started in the Gulf War, in the first Gulf War in the 1990s. But of course, the post 9/11 war on terror expanded these bases considerably, and they were not popular locally. And just to give you a sense of how the IRGC writes up their field reports, this is how the IRGC does it. They say the 18th wave of Operation True Promise 4 has begun. We remind the arrogant enemy the movements of American soldiers in Qatar and Bahrain and their use of non-military facilities in Persian Gulf countries are not hidden from us. No amount of air defense systems will help you. So that's how that was announced before those drones were launched. So it's almost like an early warning, but effectively telling exactly what is being hit. And I think we'll see that in these next few. These are pinpoint strikes. And that's the thing is about the drones. You could make them pinpoint. That's what they do. They hit right where they're supposed to go, GPS tracked, to get them exactly on their topic, or Russian, in a lot of cases, Russian GPS is being used. The UAE says that they have endured more than 800 drones and 186 ballistic missiles. So more than 1,000 targeting just the UAE itself. And it has a major U.S. airbase there too, Al Fahra Air Base. In Qatar, they say 100 ballistic missiles, 3 cruise missiles, 24 drones. Kuwait was 180 ballistic missiles, 400 drones, 100 missiles in Bahrain and 76 drones, and dozens in Saudi Arabia. This is the Prince Sultan Saudi Air Base. More destruction of those satellite terminals. So direct hits on these bases. We're going to take a look at Jordan now. This is the key U.S. expeditionary base, Muwafaq al-Salti, clearly a direct ballistic missile hit on that air base. The drones are mostly shot out of the sky using fighter jets and helicopters. So they blast them out of the sky and the pieces fall all over Jordan. That's part of the deal, I guess, with the king. And again, at this airbase, it's key because this is a concentration of U.S. forces on top of the expeditionary air wing that's already based at that base in Jordan. There has been 6 U.S. soldiers killed on these bases in these attacks. These are the only casualties that the Americans have admitted to. DropSite has done some reporting that they believe the number is being suppressed significantly. But we will have to see in the coming days when the honesty of casualties comes out, because we're particularly not hearing about wounded soldiers. And also, just to say, those drone strikes that were hitting those hotels, those are not killing locals. The number of locals killed in each of these countries is in the single digits throughout this war. And we're not clear who they are, if they're on the base, if they're base workers. All of that stuff is still all fuzzy at this point, but we will keep track of that, of course. The embassies have all been evacuated, but also the CIA bases attached to the embassies have also been evacuated because they were hit in Riyadh the other day, and the CIA announced that everybody was to evacuate. Now, for this next one, this is the shooting down of 3 U.S. F-15s that were downed by apparently Kuwaiti-friendly fire. All 3 of them right in a row here. These are F-15E Strike Eagles falling from the sky. You could see the ejection of the pilots there. According to CENTCOM, all 6 pilots survived. When they reached the ground, all were treated well by the population when they landed. 3 more lost fighter jets. We know they lost 3 during the Yemen battles as well. And the key to this is not just that it's an accident that happens. The key is that it's during active combat. It's when missile drone combo attacks are happening, layered attacks are happening, incoming, that creates the confusion, that creates the friendly fire, or in the case of Yemen, where the aircraft carrier had to do a sharp turn and therefore lost the plane overboard. But that's not just happening in a vacuum. It's happening in the moment of a complex strike that's happening directly on these forces. So they are friendly fire, but they're very much a forced error, if we can use a tennis term there. So there was also reporting today, I won't get into that, but there may have been a 4th fighter jet, American fighter jet, shot down in Iran. There's early reporting about that. We'll have to wait to confirm all of that. And all of this stuff takes a lot to confirm because there has been a lot of misinformation, disinformation, purposeful misguidance of what's going on as part of the propaganda campaign happening here. Let's take a look at Dubai now. So that was the U.S. consulate in Dubai, an emptied one. The Ministry of Defense of the UAE has been putting these out. They say they have detected 186 ballistic missiles launched towards them. They say they have intercepted 172 of them. Not sure how good these stats are, but they're putting them out. And it's interesting for at least what they are seeing coming at them. You're talking about 8 cruise missiles and 812 Shahed drones fired at them. So more than 1,000 projectiles fired at the UAE alone in this case. So significant focus on the UAE as well. The IRGC Aerospace Force has downed a number of drones. I attempted to do a count of them because to see if we can match them up. But we have footage like this footage clearly here of an Israeli Hermes 900. There's an Elbit drone, one less Elbit drone. Here comes another Elbit drone blasted out of the sky. And then there's a third one here that's an Israel Aerospace Industries Heron drone that you can tell the difference between them because of the back wing. So these are being knocked out of the sky every day in Iran. We see footage of them on the ground. We've seen some of this footage from the missile cam. It seems to be the same, the 358 that the Yemenis were using to down a couple of dozen MQ-9 Reapers. So far, these are all Israeli drones that we've seen drop, although the Iraqi resistance reported that they got an MQ-9 Reaper. If they did, I'm sure we will be seeing that in due time. We've seen more than a dozen for sure, separate drops. The Iranian army is also doing air defense. They do an integrated air defense with the IRGC, and they put their number of drones downed in the many dozens, something like 30 through these days, but difficult to verify because we don't have footage of all of them. The Ansar Allah movement always gave us footage to match their claims. So we'll see if this reporting crystallizes more in the coming weeks. This is the Hermes 900. This appears to have been taken down by electronic warfare because it is perfectly, more or less perfectly intact. And the IRGC said that it was under the control of the fighters of the Aerospace Force of the IRGC. And there you can see it's loaded out, hadn't used them yet on this particular drone, but definitely not seeing this on news that I'm watching. So I thought I'd bring you this angle, as I always do. And then this was an interesting story because the U.S. has actually cloned the Shahed drone and have their own. And they announced the launch, historic first. They said this was on day 2. We're looking at a CENTCOM press release. It says CENTCOM's Task Force Scorpion Strike for the first time in history is using one-way attack drones in combat during Operation Epic Fury. These low-cost drones, modeled after Iran's Shahed drones, are now delivering American-made retribution. So again, blustery American military announcements. It only took some few hours before the Iraqis were picking apart one of these Lucas drones, low-cost drones that look exactly like the Iranian drones and are run on Starlink. You could see the Starlink satellite dangling off there. So That was less than 24 hours turnaround from them boasting about retribution to Iraqis in the desert laughing and having fun with the drone, trying to decide what to do, if it can fit in their pickup truck or not. It's sort of like the footage we used to see in Yemen when the drones would down. So that's a remarkable little turnaround there for their copycat drones. And now Hezbollah joined the war. I think Hezbollah joined the war this week, but the war was going to join Hezbollah. So I think that they got out in front of it. There hasn't been a ceasefire. The ceasefire has been in many ways more fraudulent in Lebanon than it is in Gaza, even, which is hard to say because it's been brutal in Gaza. But in Lebanon, the number of violations is in the tens of thousands, and the number of Hezbollah commanders, operatives, soldiers killed is more than 500. There's daily strikes. Israel was not going to let Hezbollah be on the sidelines of this war. So Hezbollah joined the war 2 days ago, and immediately we get clips like this. We see a Merkava tank there in the distance. And again, this is at the top of the Galilee Panhandle. And that's a Cornet anti-tank guided missile that's going to be launched, and a direct hit as it spools its way on target. This is a remarkable shot, multiple kilometer shot. I didn't do the calculation myself, but I saw a calculation from a source that said that this was 5 kilometers, which would make sense. And again, this is an area that Hezbollah is not supposed to be, let alone. The first shot was clearly by their anti-tank marksman, because that is a long-distance shot and it hit perfectly. The Israelis have said that there has been several injuries inside tanks that have been hit by anti-tank guided missiles. So Hezbollah is back, 36 operations in the first 2 days. Hezbollah said on this post of this video, they said that of the field report, they said the Islamic Resistance is committed to defending its land and people, especially as the Israeli enemy crosses boundaries with its crimes. Its response targeted military sites, unlike the enemy, which targets civilians. So Hezbollah saying we target military sites, and they have rocket and drone attacks on Israeli bases all across the front line, which now includes Syria, because the Israelis are occupying Syria now as well. So they were targeted there by Hezbollah. And the Iraqi resistance joined immediately. They didn't need any prompting. They joined the war in the first minutes of the war and began hammering the American air base at Erbil in northern Iraq, as well as the two other American air bases, Ain al-Assad in western Iraq, and then they have the U.S. base at Baghdad airport. So that's the air base that you're seeing in flames there from the Iraqi resistance. And just one more, after all of this, the U.S. sent out this notice this week. This is from the State Department that says, security updates for Americans in the Middle East. Depart now via commercial means due to serious safety risks. And it lists the countries: Bahrain, Egypt, Iran, Iraq, Israel, the West Bank, Gaza, Jordan, Kuwait, Lebanon, Oman, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, Syria, United Arab Emirates, and Yemen. So essentially the Americans saying, we're too busy protecting Israel right now to worry about our people in the region. We sprung the war on them so fast that they didn't have reasonable chance to get their families out of the region. And they say to them, depart now and you're on your own. Although I did hear yesterday on the news that instead of just hanging up on people calling the embassies, that there's now a recorded message. So just real kind of a last thing to just say that the focus is never seems to be for the America Firsters on the Americans. That was all a big fraud. So this has been the Resistance Report for day 6 of the war in Iran.
That was the Electronic Intifada's John Elmer.